Welcome to episode 10 of The Day Today, our continuing exploration of how we can use satellites to understand the environmental and Earth system that we live in. I'm joined today again by Dr. Hayley Evers-King. Hi, Hayley.
Hi, Mark.
Nice to see you again. And for the first time, Dr. Paolo Ruti, who is UMetSat's new chief scientist. Welcome.
Thanks. Hello, everybody.
And welcome again to UMetSat. Now, the Arctic is something that you've been working on for quite some time, Paolo. What's the why explore the Arctic? Why understand the Arctic? Why does it matter?
I think the Arctic is an interesting case because it's not, in the past, it was really a place for the new frontier, the new adventure. And I think we know that the Nordics, the Nords, they were navigating and probably visiting Greenland and other parts. But since Columbus discovered the Americas, there was a tentative from the humankind to find another passage through and to go quicker to Asia. So that was since the 15th century, that was already something that people, they really tried to. And so it was really one of the last frontier. It's still today one of the last frontier.
Mm. And from a scientific perspective, when did exploration sort of start? When were the first scientific missions or journeys to the Arctic?
Yeah, I think that was probably since the 17th and 18th century. Mm. So those expeditions, they were not only, of course, they were going there to discover something, to discover Northeast or Northwest Passage. They were both routes to the Asia. And I think that, and one famous tentative was during the 18th century. There were many, many tentatives there, and most of them, they were being lost. Mm. And they were accompanied by scientists taking measures, temperature. So the Navy was really advanced, especially that was that time that was the Brit Empire. So there was the Navy was really strong on not only on discovering, but also on taking scientific trips. So it's not only the Arctic. You can think about Darwin and going through the Pacific. So that was really when discovering new uncharted territories was always together, going together hand-to-hand with science.
And it fitted, I guess, with the political aspirations that were held at that time, the sort of empire-building ideas. But skipping forward to today, so last winter we saw the Polar Stern experiment, which I guess fits in the heritage of Arctic science exploring. What was that about?
Yeah, that's... I think that has been the idea to, I mean, that was in the 17th, 18th century was a big risk for ships to be trapped by the ice. And because, of course, the ship were wooden made and that would have been destroyed by the strength of the ice. Now it became a great scientific expedition with the Polar Stern that on purpose has been trapped into the ice, and it was drifting with the ice, because we have all the idea that as soon as the Arctic is covered by ice, that is becoming extremely static, which is not true. Mm. The ice is drifting together with the ocean current underneath, and so this is why the Polar Stern has been trapped on the northeast part, and this was drifting down towards Greenland. And that was together with a lot of multidisciplinary measurements. So it's not only physics, but also biology and other measurements. Mm. That was the idea, to collect this large amount of data to better understand how the Arctic environment is changing, and it's changing so fast. We know this.
So, Paolo, with the Polar Stern expedition, I'm an oceanographer by training, so I've actually never been on a cruise myself, which is quite ridiculous. But being a somewhat dry oceanographer using satellites, I'm always fascinated to see what's going on cruises that are out there actually, hands-on exploring our oceans. I get to do it from my desk, they get to do it from a ship. So in terms of the Polar Stern, what were some of the science outcomes that came from the expedition?
I think you should consider that one expedition, it takes several years to really understand the full spectrum of outcomes. I was I was participating to other big, let's say, campaigns in Africa, and after 10 years, you continue to see published papers from those data. So I think the first outcome is the fact that for the first time, you had the chance to collect data from temperature to biological samples, and this has been the great, and that was everything collocated on the same site, because one of the problem that most of the time you have spread data and you need to link those data and to try to figure out what is the consequence of the climate change. I think the main scientific frontier is to connect what we know from the geophysical side to the impact side, and this is the last mile, I think, to really, and for such a pristine regions, no, you have probably places still in the Arctic that have never been touched by humankind, or that's still something quite amazing, and this is where probably the Polar Stern adventure was as probably will give us a lot of outcome. And back to what we know about the Arctic, we know that there is an acceleration, it's like a thermometer of the planet, and we can see there just in advance what is happening around the world, and there is certainly an acceleration of the impact of the climate change. So the pace of the trend of the reducing the extent of the ice or increasing in temperature in the ocean. You said you are trained as an oceanographer, so probably a question to you would be how the ocean is so important. Why the ocean is so important for the climate change?
That's a really good question. I mean, the ocean in general, being this huge component of our Earth system, I guess, is one thing that makes it super important to climate change. But particularly when we're looking at places like the Arctic, I mean, there's so much modulation of the climate that goes on in sort of a feedback with the Arctic. I mean, we have the Arctic Ocean itself. The ocean itself interacts with the sea ice. It interacts with how we store and move heat around the planet. And the Arctic is kind of this area where a lot of this is focused due to the way the feedbacks work from an ocean perspective. In terms of things like we have deep water formation that happens around the Arctic or North Atlantic into the Arctic and is influenced by the amount of freshwater input that comes from the Arctic areas. We also have the impact of the ocean and its heat content on the ice itself and the feedback this creates in terms of things like albedo and how that affects heat that comes into the planet and is reflected back. So the ocean and the Arctic are kind of this really closely integrated feedback system, if you like. And because the ocean sort of underpins the entire Arctic region, it affects all the different sort of downstream impacts that you're saying. I mean, it can also affect our weather, which I'm sure Mark can tell us a bit more about maybe in a minute, and all the things that the peoples in these regions rely on, right? I mean, the ocean is a way we transport things. It's where we get food. If the ocean changes, so does our dependence on it in lockstep. So really, the ocean is kind of a central part of the climate change story, particularly when it comes to the Arctic region.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great summary. I would say that for the Arctic, which is, I think, because we always speak about the ice, so we always consider science a kind of static place. No, nothing is happening. In reality, the ocean is the variability of the ocean is quite high, and the Arctic is influenced by both the Pacific. So you have the on the Pacific side, you have interaction with the Arctic, and then you have the Atlantic. Up to a scale, the Atlantic is so important that nowadays we are speaking about Atlantification of the Arctic. No, those Atlantic water entering the Arctic and increasing the temperature in the last few decades, also by around 1.5 degrees, which is huge. A large increase of temperature is if you consider the impact on the Arctic. And this is not only, I think, it, it has not only an effect on the minimum sea ice extent that we know, because the newspaper they always issue in September the news that the Arctic reached a new minimum in terms of ice extent, so everybody knows that September is more or less the time we have this minimum. But this temperature increase in the ocean and what we call the mixed layer, which is probably the closest part to the of the ocean to the surface, has an impact on the long term, on the also when there is a maximum extent of ice, so in winter time. And you can see this effect on the thinning of the ice. So you still cover all the Arctic by ice if you are there in December, January, but certain part of the Arctic are the ice is thinner compared to the past because of this water temperature increase.
So it's literally with a warmer ocean you get less of the freezing during the cooler months and you end up with thinner ice, and so your the healing effect of winter is then less pronounced.
I've heard it referred to a lot as well as younger ice, right? I mean, it's not, it's thinner in a lot of places, but it's also younger, where we get new ice that's forming and it doesn't maintain for many, many years. So like a larger proportion of the Arctic now apparently is covered by this kind of very young ice that's, you know, a year or maybe only a few years old, as opposed to in the past where it would have been ice that is built up on over many, many years. And this, of course, affects the whole dynamics of how ice works, you know, how long does it stay? It's, you know, it's not just sort of individual like components of it. It acts as kind of this larger edifice, if you like. And depending on how thick it is, how young it is, how long it's been there, will affect how easily and rapidly it melts in response to different conditions. So it's a very dynamic system, the ice. You know, you say we think about it as kind of this static lump that maybe melts a bit each year, but it's actually way more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And that's what I think where a lot of our research is going on at the moment is trying to look into what is what are the dynamics of the ice? How do we understand it? What is making it change the way it is? And, you know, to help us understand how is it going to change if we know what the conditions are going to be, or we can predict what they're going to be in the coming, you know, years to decades to centuries.
You can think about a sandwich, no? You have this thin layer of ice, which is your mayonnaise into the sandwich, and then you have up the upper part, which is the atmosphere, and the lower part, which is the ocean, and both they are, as Hayley was alluding, they are influencing what is the ice extent. You have the ocean, we said a lot about. I think that's extremely important. Then you have the atmosphere, and the atmosphere, of course, is playing a big role because you have radiation effect where our satellite become to be very important because we measure, I think most of the satellite measures radiations. But this radiation has an important interaction with the sea ice. More white surface you have, more reflection of the radiation, of the solar radiation you have. While on the contrary, if you start by any mechanism to reduce this, the ice extent, you have ocean water. So this interaction, the albedo effect, what we call the albedo effect, this interaction, I mean, this you capture more radiation, solar radiation, and this decrease, in turn, decrease the sea ice extent. So you have this positive effect going on.
So let's turn it, I guess, to the observing system, because that's our part of it. What are some of the current instruments that we have, both as UMETSAT and also for the Copernicus site that we look after, that are measuring the Arctic environment?
This is definitely one for me, I guess, particularly from the ocean side. As Paolo was saying just then, really, most of our satellites have something to offer in terms of the Arctic and how we measure it. Because it is this multifaceted system, you know, we're looking at the ocean, we're looking at the atmosphere, we're looking at land, we're looking at ice, both on land and on sea, we're looking at temperature. You know, most of our Earth observation fleet has something to say about some of those parameters. And, you know, that's really, I mean, it's really good for us because this, without this level of coverage of data from all these different angles, we can't really get a handle on these complex dynamics that are influencing the system. From my perspective, I mean, I work on Sentinel 3 and more recently Sentinel 6 as part of the Copernicus program. Sentinel 3 has a number of sensors on it that offer us information about the Arctic. I mean, it has a temperature sensor so we can get SST. It has an altimeter so we can get some information about ice from that. And the actually the SST as well as giving a sea surface temperature, we will soon have a sea ice product that our colleagues at UMass are currently working on to bring out. And that's, so we'll be able to talk about the temperature of the ice itself, as well as its presence or lack thereof. And then lastly, the sort of third instrument that we have on Sentinel-3 Multi, this is the ocean colour sensor, gives us an insight into the biology. And as Paolo was saying just now, one of the things that's happening with the Arctic is when this ice melts, if you have more ocean exposed, and the ocean is dark, so this changes how the light is absorbed or reflected, and the heat effect is there. But this also affects the light environment in the ocean itself. So whilst the Arctic, if you look at the surface of it, is becoming darker because more of it is ocean, in the ocean is becoming brighter in the Arctic because it's now more exposed to sunlight more often because it's not covered by ice. And, you know, this affects the biology at a fundamental level in the ocean, because it's all, for the most part, biology in the ocean is driven by the presence of sunlight through the growth of phytoplankton. And Ultra is able to actually, because it's got quite high resolution, pick up a lot of interesting features around the edges of ice where we're getting, you know, sort of new water, if you like, being more regularly exposed and seeing what's happening with the production there. And this is also part of the climate change story, because this affects the absorption of things like carbon, it affects production and fisheries and all the way up the food chain. So there's a whole, you know, insight we've got there into biology as well from the sensors. And Sentinel 6 with its new higher resolution altimetry will also help us look more at some of these features that are relevant to the altimetry as well. So looking at things like the ice thickness and presence of ice too.
Yeah. And I guess on the UMetSat side, we've also got the data that contributes to the Copernicus program. So the ice data from the scatterometers that also give us winds, as well as also cloud information and things like that.
These are all compiled by our team in the OCSAF, and also by the teams in the Copernicus Marine Service. They actually combine data from a lot of the Sentinel satellites, but also from our own missions at UMetSat, to provide these sort of combined downstream products, if you like, to maximize the coverage and information, which is really crucial in areas like the Arctic. You know, you need as much coverage of data as you can get, particularly because in some cases it's not easy to see. It's a really difficult to access area physically, but also in a lot of cases from the satellite, the more satellites you've got working to observe this, the more data we have, the more we can understand the dynamics as precisely as we need to.
Yeah, that's probably one of the gaps that we are working on, is the availability of data, is the amount of data, so the frequency we can provide data there. So this is why UMetSat, in collaboration with ESA and others, are working towards this Arctic weather system that could be a potential constellation of small sat, because this is specifically for the atmosphere, to try to understand from the microwave measurements what is the how stratified is the atmosphere, what is the profile of temperature, or are the other variables, humidity, etc. Because the weather in the Arctic is I think there's a large variability there. And you have, on the large scale, you have the Icelandic low, which is extremely important because it is interact with the sea ice and the ocean. Actually, it will increase the loss. If you strengthen the Icelandic low, you will increase the loss of the sea ice. But then you have a lot of other small scale features, storms happening there. You have fog. Now, all these events, weather events, that are extremely dangerous for ship routing or for the tourism sector. We were speaking recently with the Norwegian tourist sector, and this is where they really need a lot of information, because to plan a cruise around the Arctic is not the same as if you are in the Mediterranean, maybe. So that's where our satellite effort is extremely important. And with the Arctic weather system, we can dramatically increase the amount of data. Yeah.
And this is what's new for us, I guess, is integrating smaller satellites into the operational constellation. So from a satellite operations perspective, is interesting, but also really fills the gap. I know as well there's a Russian approach for Arctic monitoring, which is using this highly elliptical orbit. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think it was planned since many years, and then the Russian, successfully launched this payload. So the idea is that you are stretching your elliptic orbit in a way that you will pass most of the time, so the satellite will pass most of the time around one of the pole, and then it will go quickly over the rest of the Earth. And so you will spend a lot of time, and you will go slowly until you reach really you see. So you have a view, an amazing view of the Arctic from above, and this is give you the possibility to take a lot of measurements. Not only microwave, but also other infrared and so far. So this is really an advanced capacity for the community. I think Canadians also, they are working towards this, and maybe in the future also other agencies like NOAA, they are probably have long-term plan. The idea is for EUMETSAT is to work, and this is where EUMETSAT is extremely strong in collaborating with all these agencies. That's also an added value for our friend living in the Arctic.
I think it's one of Hayley and I's favorite themes is international collaboration and the sharing of data, and the fact that the Arctic, I guess the idea of shared challenge. Yes, there's a degree of geographic competition for the Arctic, but there is also a degree of scientifically understood, this is a shared challenge for us to understand. So data sharing comes quite easily. Looking to the future, are there any new missions coming up within the Copernicus arena that focus on the Arctic?
Yeah, there's a couple actually. This is it's interesting what Paolo was saying there about things like the orbits and stuff. So when we're planning missions at a global scale, we often have to make different trade-offs to get optimal coverage. And if we're covering the whole globe, the trade-offs we might make will be different to if we're focusing on a specific area, for example. And things like the Arctic do require a little bit of a specific approach if we really want to get the density of data and the types of measurements that are optimal for this. So this is kind of motivated within the coming phase of the Copernicus program for a couple of new missions, two of which will be operating at EUMETSAT. So this is the Simmer and Crystal. I'll use the acronyms because the actual names are really long. But in short, one of them is looking is a radiometer, which will be looking at the sea surface temperature at high resolution, which is important for understanding our ocean dynamics up there, and sea ice concentration. So with that sort of radiometer instrumentation, you can look at both the sea surface temperature, the sea ice temperature, and the sea ice concentration.
So this is microwave, so it can see through the clouds,
which is really useful because the Arctic is very cloudy. This is a problem that we have with some of our other instruments, is that they can't readily see through clouds. They have benefits on the other side because of that, usually in the resolution, but it does make it more difficult. So we have Simmer, and then we also have Crystal, which is another altimetry mission, but more designed again to focus specifically on looking at the snow and ice environments, particularly around the Arctic. So this is all supporting the European Union's Arctic policies. And we'll from that be able to get information on things like the sea ice thickness, depth of snow, the elevation of the ice sheets, all helping us to get a better handle on that complex ice sheet dynamics that I was talking about before.
So as you look to sort of this current period, I'm just checking the clock and we don't have so much time left. What are some of the observations that we have now, or some of the scientific themes that are being explored now or in the future that most excite you? I guess Paolo first.
I think it's probably in the near future there will be a combination between geophysical and biological parameters. I think it's one area that will be extremely important to understand what is happening in the Arctic. You are reducing the sea ice extent, which means that phytoplankton and plankton, because of the sunlight, I think it's increasing. So you are, on one side, the biological variability, it's increasing, which could be good and bad. I think it's a question mark, because we are losing a lot of biodiversity, specific Arctic biodiversity, and there are a lot of problems with other web or ecosystems. And you have new species coming from the mid-latitudes entering the Arctic. And so this is where we need also to increase our capacity to monitor across these different webs.
And Hayley?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo what Paolo said there for sure about the sort of ocean dynamics in between the physical and the biological. I think that's really interesting and something that's going to become more and more that we're able to look at with some of these new missions in particular. And it's quite vital because it touches on all the different aspects of the system, and then eventually through the food webs on both life in the Arctic from a sort of animal and human perspective. But I'm going to go with something different, because, you know, something non-ocean, because I'm always interested in the rest of sort of how our world works as well. And I find it really interesting looking at things like the dynamics of the permafrost and things like the potential for increased fires in the Arctic, and something probably to talk in another podcast about. But we know there's been a lot of fires in recent years. And so our ability to monitor those and the impact that's going to have on sort of land dynamics is going to be, well, interesting and challenging in quite a sad way. But, you know, with the tools that we have, we can hopefully understand what's going on there a bit more and, you know, protect human life and monitor what's going on a bit better.
And we're seeing that at the moment, I guess, with some of the Arctic, well, not quite Arctic, but Siberian fires. And you, Paola mentioned the albedo later on, earlier on. And so the idea of the smoke and some of the stuff that comes from the fires actually lands on the white surface, reduces its albedo, and dramatically changes some of the reflectivity. And so the energy balance that we have there as well.
Yeah, and of course, all this plays into the, or it's very interacts a lot with the weather angle as well. Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in the weather, as every human, I think, is, especially those of us who are British, have this peculiar obsession with the weather. But often I find in recent years that we hear, you know, there's a weather system that's happening, that's coming through, you know, at the moment where we are in sort of Northern Europe, and they say, oh, it's coming from the Arctic. So that connection between us and the Arctic is quite strong. From a weather perspective, and I'm interested to see how that's going to change. And I think the, you know, the monitoring system that we've got now will help us to be better able to predict that. And we know that a lot of the, both the challenges that are happening in the Arctic in terms of some of the more extreme events and the more extreme events that are happening, you know, in Europe where we, you know, larger populations live, are very dependent on this dynamic sort of weather activity that happens between the Arctic and Northern Europe. So
yeah. And I think that's something we're maybe becoming a little bit more aware of just now with the Northern Hemisphere Northern Hemisphere summer season that has been quite significant or meaningful, and particularly with this meandering jet stream, which is partly tied up to having a warmer Arctic. If you have a warmer Arctic, it constrains the positioning of the jet stream slightly less. So it meanders a lot more, and we can end up with these kind of weather patterns that we've been seeing in North America and Northern Europe and out to Northern Asia over this summer period. So it's quite an interesting time to be studying the Arctic and its effects.
Yeah, I think the one interesting outcome that from a big project I was working on during my WMO period was the polar prediction project. If you increase the amount of observations over the Arctic, the positive effect on our on predictability, or our capacity to predict weather in mid latitudes, is increasing. So what is happening in the Arctic, it doesn't stay in the Arctic. It has consequences. It's not only the sea level rise that we usually quote, which is of course important because there is an impact from the freshwater and general dynamics of the sea ice and the ice sheet. But there is also a direct effect, which is an immediate effect. If you increase the amount of data observation over the Arctic, you are actually increasing your capacity to predict weather events over mid latitudes, over Europe. And this is, I think, you see the consequences of weather extreme events even nowadays. And I think that is an important message we have to launch.
Just in closing, anything you would like to add in closing, Hayley, first?
I think the Arctic really represents probably kind of the pinnacle of some of the challenges that we face around climate change and the complexity of doing kind of interdisciplinary science. And it can sound, I think, quite depressing, you know, when you look at what's happening. But there's also a lot of opportunity here, and a lot of our kind of best science and technologies are coming together to kind of address challenges in this region. And as much as that, you know, what is happening is, you know, say, quite depressing, it's also quite inspiring. So I would, you know, encourage people to kind of look at the opportunities that we have to address these challenges with some of this amazing technology and really, you know, take some optimism from that.
I can echo what Aileen said. I think we know that in the past, I mean, there was the last interglacial period, there was 130,000 years ago, there was a large increase of temperature, but we know that time it was due to the orbit change, etc. So nowadays it's because of us. And so it's on us to try to find actionable solutions.
So we will know if we're making a difference to our lives and reducing particularly carbon. by the impacts we see in the Arctic. Hayley,
yes.
Paolo, thank you very much for joining. If you are interested in knowing more about this data, do have a look at the UMATSAT website. And round about September, on any of the Copernicus partner websites, you will be able to see information on the sea ice. You'll see in the bottom corner, there'll be a little UMATSAT logo. All of our data feed into that. It's a collaborative effort, but we're quite pleased of our contribution. And you'll see the tracking of that sea ice, and you will see what level of sea ice minimum we hit this year. You'll be able to have a look if you go to the Ocean and Sea Ice SAF, we'll put it in the links to the show notes. You'll be able to see the current status of sea ice if you're interested in that. And we will return to the Arctic in future episodes and look at very specific elements like the ice, biodiversity, and fires. Thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to seeing you in the future.